The Financial Times guides you through complex issues. In divisive times, don't settle for black and white. When you need the full perspective, turn to FT.com. Become a subscriber today. Search for FT subscription.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast, episode 890. It's the 5th of October 2017. On the podcast today, I have Graham Lumsden, CEO of Motif Bio, that's MTFB, and Graham talks about the positive top-line results in Phase 3 study for their drug Eclipram. Also on the podcast, I have Michael Masterman, CEO of Saffron Energy, and Michael talks about the heads of terms agreement for the combination of Saffron Energy with Po Valley Operations and Sound Energy Italy. Plus, I have Chris Bailey, founder of FinancialOrbit.com, talking about Tesco's, Centrica and DFS, and Alan Green, CEO of Brand Communications, talking about Advanced Oncotherapy, Redstone Connect and AB Dynamics. Plus, as always, I have the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs too.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Graham Lumsden, CEO of Motif Bio, that's MTFB. Ticket. Graham, thanks for joining me.
You're very welcome, Justin.
And we've been talking about this day for a while, haven't we? And it's finally come. The results are out. We'll get into the positive results here on Eclipram in a bit. Before we do that, Graham, for people not aware of Motif Bio or people joining the podcast for the first time, listening for the first time, explain, what is Motif Bio all about, please, Graham?
Yes, absolutely. Motif Bio is a biotech company focused on the development of novel antibiotics. The world desperately needs new antibiotics. We have one in our lead program, which is called Eclipram, and it's late stage, meaning we just announced today the top line results from the second of two phase three trials. So I think it's an interesting story for investors who are interested in playing this antibiotic space, which seems to be in the media on a regular and frequent basis.
Yeah, and for people not aware, essentially, when you're testing drugs, it's basically three phases, isn't there? But your phase three, which is the last phase, was in two parts. It was Revive 1, Revive 2, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think they were exactly the same testing, but on different people. Is that right?
Yes, that's exactly right. So the health authority in the United States is called the Food and Drug Administration, or people refer to the FDA. And when we met the FDA back in April of 2015, they asked us to conduct two well-controlled phase three trials. And so that's what we've done. And we announced the top-line results from the first one, which is called Revive 1, in April of this year. And this second one, Revive 2, is identical in design, the protocol, the type of patients that have been enrolled, identical to Revive 1, but it took us a little bit longer to complete the second trial. And we announced in August that we'd completed the patient enrollment phase, and now this morning we announced the top-line results from Revive 2. So two trials have been asked for by the FDA, we've now done them, and we have the top-line results from both.
Excellent. So explain top-line results. I mean, it looks good. The market has reacted very well. In the UK, you ended up over 20% up on the day. It was a lot higher than that at the start, but you always get a bit of trading going on. People are taking a bit of profit. So top-line results. Explain, Graham, what does it mean by top-line results? And where do we go from here? But first of all, start with the results, please, if you could.
Yeah, so top line means really the most important data. If you imagine a clinical trial like this, there are over 600 patients involved. They're from over 40 different clinical trial sites throughout race, culture, age, presence of diabetes, kidney damage. There's just a huge amount of information from all their blood tests, the results from the studies. And that takes a lot of analysis and assessment on the part of the clinical research organization. So what they've done for us is said, well, here's the most important stuff, the top line results. Did you meet the primary endpoint, which is what the study is designed to show? Yes. And then we'll get all the other data over the next several weeks to months. So top line is the most important data. That's what we have.
Excellent. And as far as you're concerned, these are as good, or they exceeded? What's the score?
Yes, I would say they're actually a little bit better than we were anticipating. They look a little bit better than Revive 1, just in terms of the numbers. This is a very important piece, and it's difficult, I think, for people to grasp if you don't do clinical trials every day. Mm-hmm. These trials are designed to show that you are no different to a comparator antibiotic. In this case, we used the standard of care antibiotic, vancomycin. The reason that they're designed to show what's called non-inferiority, which is a fancy name for about the same, mm-hmm. is you can't compare what's called placebo. Placebo means patients get no treatment. You can't compare your new antibiotic against no treatment because the patients who would receive no treatment might end up dying. So you have to compare to a standard of care antibiotic. And the thinking is if you show that it's similar, but in the case of Iclaprim, it's a very different mechanism, so it kills bacteria in a totally different way to vancomycin, mm-hmm. then that's the reason why similarity is good enough for regulatory purposes, and you bring a novel antibiotic like Iclaprim to market that has a different mechanism. So yes, I mean, the what we announced today, the primary endpoint was how many patients, 48 to 72 hours after starting an antibiotic, had at least a 20% reduction in the lesion size. What does that mean? To get into this clinical trial, patients had to have abscesses or infected surgical wounds or something else called cellulite, 5 square centimeters on their skin. So think about your iPhone, mm-hmm. not the new 10. Yeah. Think about an iPhone 8 sitting on your skin. If the lesion's bigger than the size of that iPhone, that's enough for a patient to be included in these trials. And the early clinical response is, did that lesion reduce by at least 20% at 48 to 72 hours after starting treatment? And the answer is, those patients treated with Iclaprim, 78.3% of them, yes, the lesion was reduced by at least 20%. Vancomycin, 76.7%. So although Iclaprim was numerically better, in statistical terms, it means they were about the same and similar. So that's early clinical response. That's the primary endpoint. Another important secondary endpoint is, what about test of cure? So after you've finished the course of antibiotics and then wait 7 days, did the physician judge the patient to be cured requiring no further antibiotics? And the answer in Revive 2 was, those patients treated with Iclaprim, 78% were considered cured, and for vancomycin, 77.7%. So yes, better than expected, just because numerically Iclaprim looks a bit better. It's not better statistically, but it's very pleasing to see that the numbers look better for Iclaprim. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing, of course, we measure is side effects. And side effects were exactly what we expected. Really little difference to see between the two treatment groups, Iclaprim and vancomycin, which was also encouraging to see. So yes, in line with expectations, maybe a little bit better just because of the way the numbers work.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And so now, what is next, Graham?
Yes. So now we'll take a break for half an hour, and then the team is back fully engaged in submitting this new drug application. It's thousands of pages long. It contains a preclinical section, so all the work that's been done in the laboratory and in animal studies. It contains a CMC section, chemistry manufacturing controls. That's basically all the manufacturing piece. And then the clinical section, which is what this Revive 2 data is, the final piece that needs to be included in the clinical section. So these thousands of patient pages of new drug application, the team's been working on this for many weeks now. We continue working on this, make sure that everything makes sense, make sure that we add in the Revive 2 data. And then when we get the final wealth of data from our clinical research organization over the next several weeks and months, we put that into the new drug application. And we anticipate being able to confirm that we've submitted a complete new drug application to the United States FDA by the end of the first quarter next year. From there, what happens? The FDA has 2 months to go through our NDA and make sure that it's all complete and correct and accept the filing. And then once it's accepted, because Iclaprim has been designated a qualified infectious disease product, QIDP, From that point, the FDA has 6 months to come back to us with a decision, and hopefully, obviously, we'll get an approval to market Iclaprim, and we'll be ready to enter the market and launch the product for use in hospitals for patients with serious and life-threatening infections at the beginning of 2019. So that's the core plan that the team's focusing on. Mm-hmm. Other things that we're starting to ramp up now is when can we start a hospital-acquired bacterial pneumonia trial? This is the indication where individuals are in hospital, for example, for a knee replacement or a hip replacement, and they pick up this nasty pneumonia or infection of the lungs while in the hospital, and they have a 20 to 50% mortality risk. And because of the data we already have with Iclaprim, it seems a very good antibiotic for people with hospital-acquired bacterial pneumonia. So you'll see some news flow in the next weeks to months about where we are with that. And finally, we announced that we have an orphan designation for Iclaprim in treating patients with bacterial pneumonia who also have cystic fibrosis. And we intend to announce how we're progressing with that piece over the next weeks to months as well.
Excellent. So it all looks good. And then at the end of, say, next year, if everything goes to plan and you have sort of commercialization and take it to the market there, I mean, you mentioned it before, but it's probably worth mentioning again for people. What's the commercial potential of this? I mean, obviously, I mean, I'm looking from an investor point of view, there's a huge benefit other than monetary, but to patients and everything. But, you know, as an investor looking at this as an investment, what is the commercial benefit to them here?
Right. So the key piece that Iclaprim seems to satisfy very well is of the 3.6 million patients hospitalized annually in the United States who have acute bacterial skin and skin structure infections. That's what we've just studied in these two phase three trials. Up to about one in four of them also have kidney disease. And that's the best description of the patient that's most suitable for treatment with Iclaprim. So one in four of the 3.6 million patients with nasty skin infections who also have kidney damage. If you just use the price point of current hospital antibiotics, that one in four patients represents a market opportunity, US only, of about $2.8 billion. So we're not saying we get 100% of that market, but I guess for every 10% of that market, it's about $280 million. So that's the goal for our first indication. So just those with kidney damage, just US, and then load on top of that access if we get this phase three trial for hospital-acquired bacterial pneumonia, that gives us access to additional revenue opportunities, and then the cystic fibrosis play as well.
It must be a good day for you, Graham, because, you know, you've been working so hard and we've chatted over it must have been a year or so now about this, and you finally come to this huge milestone and you've, you know, completed it successfully. I mean, the team and you must, you know, be on sort of cloud nine, aren't you, really?
I'm very proud of our team here at Motif Bio. You know, we have a very small team, 7 full-time employees, 9 monthly retained consultants. They're each in their own right superstars. For us to be able to enroll, treat, and finish 2 phase three trials in a little over 2 years is really outstanding. And we're so fortunate to have this team of individuals at Motif Bio. So yes, we talked to everyone yesterday as we were putting together the final press release. Everyone is delighted, very pleased to see the results. So yeah, we're just taking our 30 minutes out of the day today to sort of celebrate and say, pat everyone on the back and say, well done. But then we've got our work cut out to get this new drug application in. So there's no rest for the wicked yet. We're onward and upward.
Yeah, well, it's amazing. You know, it's a life-changing opportunity for patients, and it's nice to see all the hard work you put in is paying off here. So, Graham, if anyone's listening right now and they like the sound of this, but they're not yet, you know, done the research, but they're looking to, and they want to start following you, and they're on the edge of hitting that follow button on your page, give them 3 reasons why they should do that, please, Graham.
Yep. Number one, the world desperately needs new antibiotics. Dame Sally Davis, the chief medical officer in England, is concerned that we're 5 years away from a cut finger or a grazed knee again becoming fatal. Patients and hospitals are running out of options where the bacteria that are causing infections are no longer responding to the antibiotics currently available. At Motif Bio, we have a novel antibiotic called Eclipren. It works in a very, very different way, and it can be part of the solution to the looming antibiotic crisis. Number two, you can expect a lot of news flow over the next weeks to months, some of which we've mentioned on the call. The new drug application being submitted, the new drug application being accepted by FDA, a decision before the end of 2018, progress with our hospital acquired bacterial pneumonia program, our cystic fibrosis program, potential partnering announcements. So a lot of news flow going on over the next 12 to 18 months. And then thirdly, as you said at the beginning of the call, Justin, the markets responded favorably to our top-line results announced this morning. But just compare us to other antibiotic companies like Paratek, like Nabreva, like Tetraphase, like Acagen. We still have a ways to go to be fully appreciated and valued vis-a-vis our peers in the marketplace. And I think that is hopefully on the cards for us in the next 12 to 18 months as we continue to deliver news flow.
Excellent, Graham. Good to chat to you. And like you said, you've got lots of news flow, so no doubt we'll be chatting in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Michael Masterman, CEO of Safron Energy. That's S-R-O-N ticker. Michael, thanks for joining me.
Great to be on, Justin. Lots happening in the Safron front.
Yeah, I was going to say some very exciting, potentially transformational news, and we'll get to that in a bit. Before we do, as always, and this summary may be a bit different from the last time you gave it out, but give us a brief summary as to Safron Energy for people not aware of the story, please, Michael.
Okay, so Safron's listed on the AIM, ticker SRON. We focus on natural gas production in Italy and Europe, and we've just taken some steps to very substantially increase the size of our footprint and to bring on some leading executives take charge of Safron in the next phase of very substantial expansion.
Yeah, well, the title of the RNS, Heads of Terms for the Combination of Safron PLC with Po Valley Operations and Sound Energy Italy, an enlarged group to be renamed Coro Energy PLC. So it's very exciting. I'm sure lots of people are aware of the Sound Energy story, but not only because the share price has gone gangbusters, gone from about, less than sort of 20 pence a couple of years ago up to over a quid, and then it came back a bit. It's consolidating now. But James Parsons' story is one, you know, that people know about. So take us through this deal, Michael, and take us through the exciting bits there, and hopefully potentially what it will do for Safron and Coro, and what's happening, what's the story going forward here.
Okay, so what we've done, and it's a very transformationary transaction. We've taken Safron's existing production assets, which are quite rapidly increasing in terms of production growth. We're adding to them the Sound Energy Italian portfolio, and they've had great success with that as well as with their Morocco investments. And we're adding a third pool of assets, the Po Valley Energy assets, which includes the huge Tito Rico offshore Adriatic gas field development, the Selva gas development. And you put that portfolio together, it's an extremely good balanced portfolio of production assets, development assets and growth assets. And we've got a very, very strong management team to come together to run and fund it.
Yes, talk us through the management structure here, if you could, Michael.
So the proposal is that James Parsons, the chief executive of Sound, and amazing track record there, comes off the chairman. He'll be joined by Fiona McCauley, who's was the chief operating officer of Rockhopper and CEO of Echo. And we combine the sound and the Saffron management teams at the technical and operational level, and you've got an extremely talented team to drive these assets forward.
And on the finance side, how does it work?
On the finance side, it's if you like, it's a merger of equals. So it's one third Saffron, one third Sound Energy Italian assets, and one third Po Valley Energy Italian assets. So good balance, good fair deal, and great basis for very substantially increasing the size of Saffron, and very substantially increasing the gas production and exploration potential within its portfolio.
Excellent stuff. And so how long will it take before you're back listed as Coro Energy, do you think, Michael?
Look, we'll go flat out with the documentation. There's a few shareholder approvals in various places that will need to be done, but we're pretty efficient at that. And, yeah, just in terms of managing expectations, approximately 3 months before we're fully readmitted to the AIM. Can't see any barriers to that happening. And you know, a lot will happen on the ground in between now and then.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because the last time you were on, I did say, are you looking around for new things? And you were quite tight-lipped, but there was a suggestion you were on the lookout, which is this is very exciting. And how do you feel about this personally?
Yeah, we've not only got one growth option, but we've got two and arguably three or four growth options. So we've used our time wisely, and I think we're going to very substantially deliver for shareholders.
Okay. One last thing, which I suppose it can't be done at the moment, but they can hit the follow button, but obviously your price will not go up and down on Saffron because it's suspended at the moment, but they can still hit the follow button. So for anyone listening, Michael, right now, and they're not following Saffron Energy, which will obviously become Coro Energy, give them three reasons why they should hit that follow button if they're not, please.
Saffron Energy has just completed a transaction which will very, very substantially increase the size of its portfolio of gas production assets, gas development assets, and large-scale natural gas exploration assets in Italy. It will have a very strong capitalization and a very strong management team in those asset positions, and that's going to create very, very strong growth for Saffron shareholders.
Excellent stuff. Michael, good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll chat again in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
Okay, great. Thanks, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is founder of FinancialOrbit.com, Chris Bailey. All right, Chris?
Hello, Justin. Yes, good morning. Very well, thank you. Very well.
Yeah, I did notice yesterday, by the way, Centrica as one of the stocks down when Theresa May came out in a speech, and she managed to sputter out the fact that she's going to revive an energy cap, that Centrica went down. So I thought I'd have a chat about those. But before we get the stocks, Chris, I want to ask you, because I had an email asking me how many stocks I hold in my portfolio. And I was trying to work out, because I know there's no hard and fast rule to this. Some people, some funds, obviously funds a lot more money. They have hundreds. But there's no magic number, is it? Some people have, you know, I know people with three or four or five. And I know people with 30. But how many have you got around?
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. I think it depends on your personal risk preference and what you're comfortable with, what you're looking to achieve. For me, it's typically 30-something, so somewhere between 30 and 40. And I'll tell you the quick rationale for that. The first rationale is I want every single position to be a reasonable bet. And from my perspective, a reasonable bet is at least 1% of my aggregate pension fund as it is portfolio. The second thing is I want to be diversified, and I don't want any one position to be more than 5% of my pension fund, at least in terms of initial cash. If it doubles or triples or something and it pops above the 5%, that's a nice problem to have. I can deal with that. So that's typically how I view it. That's a nice balance of diversification but still making a difference, because what you don't want, in my opinion, is that really long tail, and you have an absolute corker and it doubles or triples, and it's 0.1% of your portfolio.
Yeah.
And to be honest, that's not making a difference. By contrast, you don't want, in my view, I'm not comfortable with 7, 10, 15% of my portfolio in one stock. You know, there are names that I absolutely love at prevailing prices or have done in the past, but, you know, I kept my discipline. Because even those great names can bog it up, unfortunately. That's just the way it goes. That's the wonderful world of the markets.
Yeah, and how much do... I mean, I'm a bit more exposed than that. I'm between 5, 10% in most of mine, but... Because I worked out, I tried to do the maths on it in my head, and I thought, let's say for round figures, you have a portfolio worth £100,000, and you've got a stock, say, of 5% exposure. If a stock does really well and doubles, say it's got 5 grand in it, so it's 5%. Say a stock doubles... that's now worth 10 grand, you've only made, 5% gain on that in your portfolio value. That's not a lot considering that stock has doubled, is it?
No, it isn't. But, you know, as always, risk control is important too. So, you know, conversely, if the stock halved, if it's got the capability to double, it certainly got the capability to halve, you know, you would have lost... 2.5%. So, you know, it's horses for courses, really. You do what you're comfortable with. My view is the stock market's probably, on average, over the medium to longer term, however you want to define that, is probably something that's going to generate you 6, 7, 8% a year, including wrapping around dividends if you have a few dividend paying stocks. Now, we all know that the reality is there'll be some corker years and there'll be some downright shabby years. That's as I say, the wonderful world of the market. So to anticipate one stock giving you, in your example, Justin, a 5% portfolio bump on its own, to me, that sounds pretty damn good, just because I guess I play the angles. You know, I've run institutional money, and I guess I am coloured a little bit by that. But it seems to me when private investors get into trouble, it's because they've got the minus 60, minus 70 percenters or worse, and that just drags you down. And if that's, you know, quite a few percent of your portfolio, my God, you need the rest to really run very hard to even have a chance of offsetting that. So do what you're comfortable with. But I think it comes down to do your research and only invest in stuff you think you understand, you've got a bit of an edge on, you understand what you're doing. And, you know, you set yourself some targets, both to maybe take some profit, but also, you know, to exercise a bit of risk control. Stop losses, they're boring, but in my experience, they save your backside more times than they hurt you, and you manage to sell at the bottom. So, you live and learn with the market. That's just the way it is.
Exactly, yeah. And as far as cash, do you have... it's always good to hold some cash sometimes. Most times, I wish I had more cash than I did in my portfolio, but do you have a percentage level for cash or not?
I always have some cash because a bit of dry powder is good. You never know if you're going to bump into that next great investment opportunity. It might be in the middle of a bull market or a bear market. You never know. I think the reality is, though, for me, I keep my investment assets segregated from my, if you like, day-to-day cash. And I think where people sometimes go wrong is when they commingle the two. For me, I have a pension fund, and consequently, that is legally segregated. I think that's quite a neat way to do it. But always make sure you're not compromising your trading or investing because suddenly you've got to pay the gas bill. Or whatever it might be. And I've heard stories about people, I remember an old boss of mine saying, I had to sell 1,000 shares in this to buy a new sofa. How boring. And guess what? That share quadrupled over the next 8 years or something. You know, that's so annoying. So my view would be, first make sure you're taking care of your bills and your general financial prudence, and then make sure that your investment assets are segregated. You're thinking those as investment assets and you keep them separate, be it through a sort of a legal structure like a SIP or an ISA or something, or just in a different account as you prefer.
Yeah, cool. Okay, well, let's look at individual. And I, like I said, a lot of that is you've learned through experience, don't you, I suppose. But anyway, talking about your experience, Chris, let's cast your experienced eyes over some stocks that have been reporting. We mentioned Centrica. We'll get to that in a bit. But let's go back to yesterday. I noticed Tesco, but general consensus was the sort of results are quite good, but the stock came back. What happened there?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, shares were up a couple of percent early doors, you know, 24 hours ago when they came out with their numbers. But the reality is that the conference call was pretty downbeat. It said, look, life is still tough. We may have reinstated the dividend. We may have made a bit more profit than before. We may have reiterated our margin targets, but life is still tough in the supermarket world. And, you know, as consumers, we see that. We see the price competition. We see the different options out there, et cetera, et cetera. So I think analysts were sort of a bit taken aback by how sort of cautious the CEO of Tesco's was. But I think if you take a sort of a take a step back view, the reality is Tesco's is on the recovery train. And it's pushed down its debt levels, always a good move. It is making more money and it has shown a pathway how it can rebuild its profitability further. Now, we all know there's lots of curveballs out there, what some of its competitors might do, whether consumers have the cash to spend as freely in supermarkets or not. But Tesco's, you know, it's a big beast. It was clearly poorly managed for a number of years. And, you know, we've currently got that excitable court case playing out at the moment, all concerned the accounting scandal of a few years back. But the reality is, I think their sort of back to basic strategy is kind of working. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the numbers dispassionately, you still haven't got much of a yield on there, but the rating, the valuation is now relatively low. And as I say, there's a pathway for improvement. So I have to say, if you like, when you go into your Tesco's, your local Tesco's, if you think that actually, well, I think they're starting to get it a bit in terms of how the store looks, how maybe you're spending your money, then consider buying the shares. I personally think they should be north of £2 at the current level of news flow. And the only reason they're not is because a lot of investors have been burnt and a lot of investors are thinking Tesco's is like what it was 2 or 3 years back. People worrying about a money raising and everything else. But I have to say, they've kicked on a bit in what is still a difficult market.
Yeah, so it's basically, I'm looking at the group sales, it was up by 0.7% and group operating profit before exceptionals was up 23.7% to £759 million. So it seems to be on the right track.
It's on the right track. The like-for-like sales were better, 7 consecutive quarters of improvement or positive numbers there. Debt's down, which is really important. And I think the Booker deal, if they do manage to do that, is actually a smart move. Because actually cash and carry and a sort of a group which encompasses cash and carry and sort of classic food retail with a pretty good convenience and internet delivery arm. Actually, that's Tesco's getting back on the front foot. Let's see if the competition authorities allow them to have it. But I have to say, I think David Lewis at Tesco's, he's done an all right job over the last 2-3 years.
Yeah, cool. Okay, let's go back to Centrica then. I just noticed a note come up there. The Centrica boss, where is that? Centrica boss urges UK to rethink price cap plan, because apparently, I don't know, he would say that, wouldn't he? But what's your take there, Chris?
Yeah, no, I mean, Kel Sapri is on that, absolutely. But look, here's the rub. I mean, what Centrica will say, I'm sure they've already said it, is that margins that they make are pretty low compared to many other industries. If they're not making margins, why should they invest? And if they're not investing and other peers like Scottish and Southern aren't investing, then the UK's got a problem over the medium term in terms of its electricity network, all of which I would totally agree with. The reality is this is all desperately political. Obviously, Centrica is the old school BG group, British Gas Group, which obviously used to be a state company, state-owned company, was privatised in about 1986, if I recall. And, you know, the reality is it has been a bit of a political football for a while, and it is undoubtedly being used as one today. Mm. But, you know, that is what it is. Bottom line is, history tells you, whenever you have political angst over the utilities, then typically that's a buying opportunity. Centrica shares were at a 14-year low. By my regard, the CEO, actually, the newish CEO, has actually done a pretty good job and has sharpened the group up a little bit. And if you believe the numbers, they're going to pay in excess of 6% yield. I think the reality is, weak governments look for vote enhancing objectives, and clearly this has gone down well potentially with the electorate. However, I note that Ofgem, the regulators, already got plans in place, and they actually will have precedence first. So the government's plans will only kick in if there's a perception the Ofgem ones haven't gone far enough. So it's desperately messy. Could I see government U-turns and all of this? Absolutely. And then, of course, we've got the absolute curveball, which is, of course, Jeremy Corbyn and Labour. you know, no political point, but my observation is they want to nationalize it. So, it's a right old messy political backdrop. But I think whenever you have that, actually shares often get oversold. And my gut feel here is that Centrica is oversold. I say 14 odd year lows, that's striking. Yeah. So if you can bear a bit of political uncertainty, I think you may find this one creeping back to where it should be, which is in the lower reaches of 200 odd p. Should be something like 220p or something. That's a fair value price for Centrica.
Yeah, I think, though, on a technical level on the chart, I'd like to see some kind of, you know, change in the direction of the trend, because otherwise it could hang around these lows for a long time. But do you know what's odd? It's almost like conservatives are playing almost towards Labour, aren't they? Or they're batting against Labour, and almost, and I saw that yesterday, as they realised Labour's gaining a bit of ground, so they're trying to sort of cover their policies a little bit, or, you know, nick a bit of their policy. And I think I just read a quote here about the boss, Ian Conn, said the main problem with the market is the standard variable tariff, and rather than cap them, we believe the standard variable tariff should come to an end for good. So he's saying it'll lead to less competition and less choice. So I probably think he knows more about the market than Theresa May does. She's just doing it for popularity, essentially, isn't she?
Yeah, you know? I would agree. And frankly, we've all seen the switching companies and the comparison websites. That is the best thing for choice and switching and keeping them. I mean, that's what a market economy does. With information, you make your decision rather than having some arbitrary price cap. You know, I'm all for free markets, but with free information provision as well, people can make a choice. So, yeah, I think price caps are not really an answer, but, you know, maybe governments have got to seem to be making an effort to inspire the masses. Who knows?
Yeah, well, do you know what? I'm really against the intervention in the market by governments. I mean, that's what obviously Labour want to do, and Conservatives are doing a bit of that. And what happens is, I mean, the market forces, if people are unaware, if Centrica are making a hell of a killing, they've got a heck of a margin, competition will start to come in. You know, that's the way the market works. If there's a lot of money to be made in a certain sector, other companies will, you know, make inroads into that sector. And that's the way competition happens in capitalism. It works. Markets work.
That's right.
Don't get involved with it, you know.
Absolutely. It's information and incentives. You know, the profit aspect provides incentives to innovate and get involved in a market. Absolutely. So, but it's not as if Centrica's making an absolute killing. In any case, their margins, I have to say, dispassionately, are, you know, desperately average. There's nothing particularly striking about them. Frankly, you could find plenty of sectors where margins are much higher. But, you know, let's face it, it's a boring utility and a political football. So there you go.
Cool. Anything else you're looking at, Chris?
Quick one on DFS. DFS, the sofa people, they're out this morning, earlier today, with some numbers. They've been back on the market a couple odd years. I have to say this reads pretty poor. A couple of numbers. Sure, revenues are slightly up, but profits down 20%. EPS is down 20-odd%. Yes, the dividend is edged up and whatever. But the striking thing for me is what they say about the future. Very challenging conditions, modest returns for this upcoming next 12 months. Let's face it, you know, we know the consumers, it's a tough old backdrop at the moment. Big discretionary things like sofas. Yeah, you can see why people maybe are just saying, look, maybe I'll just hang on another year, or DFS have to do some great special deal to induce people to come and buy some of their product. And I must admit, I have to say, I'm still haven't got my head around these four-year interest-free offers, because it seems to me as if that's just a problem waiting to happen. I know they might be very clever and do all these swap deals and whatever in the bond markets and financing markets, but for me, that sounds like a potential bad debt at some point in the future, which may come and bite you on the bottom. So, DFS, the shares, say, back on the market for the last couple of years. They had an all right first year on the market, but it's now plumbing sort of newish or close to new lows since it came back on. I would steer well clear here. But, you know, you may find a good sofa offer. That might be the better angle to play.
Yeah, so you're saying they haven't got a sale on as far as their shares are concerned. It's cheap for a reason.
Yeah, the sale's definitely on the product. So, you're probably better off spending that grand or two you're thinking about buying some DFS shares by potentially popping down, if you wish, to one of the white good areas and seeing if you can find a cracking offer.
Yeah, excellent. Marvellous, Chris. Good to talk to you, and we'll speak next week. Thanks very much.
Yeah, absolutely. That sounds good. Thanks.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is CEO of Brand Communications. It's Alan Green. You're Al.
Hello, Joss. I'm fine. Thanks. How are you?
Yes, I'm not too bad. I'm bearing up, you know.
You're bearing up. Well, it's cold now, isn't it? It's really cold. I mean, went out yesterday and I thought, oh, sweatshirt, I put a fleece on.
I was going to say, put some clothes on, Al. Strolling around the South Coast naked.
Down here in nature of Seaford, everyone's walking around Starkers, and there are some sights to see down here, but
including yourself, and naked. Alan Naturist Green. Alan at one with the greenery.
That's right, yes. All right. Nature boy.
Let's chat about Advanced Oncotherapy. I know you've been a champion of Advanced Oncotherapy all the way down the chart. There's been going down, and we're obviously, it looks like now we've finally found a bottom, and it's starting to rally strongly, isn't it?
Well, it has. I mean, it's really come back very strongly this week. But in old money, of course, there was a share consolidation. In old money, we're still about 1.5p. So really, given where the valuation of this company was, and in old money, the shares rose as high as 16, 17 pence at one point. But clearly, with the well-documented funding issues that the company's had over the year, those are now past them. And I think anyone who bothers to drive past the Harley Street premises that is under construction cannot fail to be impressed. It's the company has a treatment centre there that's on schedule to open next in I think it's March 2019, obviously there are there's a sales team out around the world, and they are they're talking about the light machine, the proton beam therapy machine, and the company is building and developing and growing. And we've always said there's great value there. If you consider they're selling, I think, one of these machines for $50-60 million, and the current market cap of the company is not even anywhere near that. So once I think this is up and running, they have the treatment center, you'll see the company, I think, will start to go on to achieve a pretty meaningful valuation. But where we are now, my view is that the share is just recovering the lost ground through the uncertainty over funding. There is now certainty over funding going forward, and the company is in a very good position. And it's and significantly and importantly, it's hitting the milestones that it laid out in the CEO's plan early this year.
It's of my opinion, right, that you can make money on any company as long as you watch it closely enough. Company. So we all chase new stocks and shares all over the place. This is a new story. This is a good story. Looking for that. But if you want to be a trader, not even particularly a trader, I think if you know one business, because let's be honest, everyone says about diversity, right? After this many stocks, this many 30, 20 stocks, 30. And the thing is, you can't really get to know 30 stocks that well. And let's be honest, each one of these stocks is a business. And there are people who will fully invest in this business. That's their only investment, and they intend to make it a go of it. So I'm thinking, if you know the business as well as almost the business owners, obviously you're not going to know as much information as them, but look at the charts as well, and you know, like, for example, 10 pence was pretty much a really odd, a really obvious round figure. It was pretty much the bottom here,
Yes.
And it went down just below that. Then it had a massive spike up from 10 pence. It went from 10 to sort of 17. Settled down, consolidated along that bit. Didn't drop below 15 for a while. And then all of a sudden shot up again. And I'm thinking, do you know what? All you'd have to do is watch that and realize this has been majorly oversold for a long time.
Yeah.
Bide your time, scale in, say, when it had that massive, it was oversold on the RSI at 10 pence. Thinking, right, so it was oversold there. It's jumped at 70 pence. I'll put a little tranche in there. And if it dipped down 10%, put another tranche in. But then you've been sitting on a lot. But even now, I think, it's pierced through the 200-day moving average. It'll come back and hopefully use that as support a little bit.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't go for it now. I'd wait until it comes back to about 35 pence, which probably will. Right. And then I just think, if you, it's almost like, almost like a sniper, or one of the best assassins in the world. You just basically stalk one stock.
Stalk
and
it.
Wait. And then literally just pile in. But obviously with risk in mind, you don't go all in. You scale in slowly. But I think any stock, in any, especially oversold stock, when they're oversold like that, the point where they're, you know, majorly oversold, the rebound will be very aggressive. So,
it,
you know,
will be,
like,
yeah,
I said,
you
could have got four times the money already in the last, since August, you know?
So, yeah, that's right. But I think also, if you take a look at the fundamentals and look at the caliber of investor that's involved here, not to mention the board who've been supportive all the way through. There's a huge board of non-exec directors. Dr. Enrico Vanni has been investing all the way through, and that's all the way up and all the way down the scale. So given some of his recent buys, he'll be very much in clover right now. So and there's AB Segura, the fund manager, and there's a video clip on the website interviewing the founder of AB Segura and just discussing the investment case for ABO, and they just take a very pragmatic view of the company, and they believe there's great value. It's a great thing that they're doing, and yeah, these things aren't built overnight, and you know, the problems of the funding issues are now well behind us, but to these investors, that funding was never really an issue anyway, and I think it was blown up out of all proportion by certain sectors of the media. And now what we're seeing is the company is just returning back to some semblance of valuation. But even then, compared on old money, it's still at 1.5p. And you know, it was at that 1.5p in old money back in 2013. So you know, I think there's great scope for recovery here, but as you say, Just, there are various points along the way where the share will continue to push higher, then it will consolidate, might dip down a bit, and that's the opportunity. That's the opportunity to be a sniper and get in and really buy this stock at a level where it offers value.
Yeah, I mean, the RSI at the moment is at 93, which, you know, that's relatively quite oversold. Overbought. It's very hot at the moment, so let it cool down. Anything else you're looking at, Al?
Yeah, a company called AB Dynamics. The epic code is ABDP. Mm-hmm. Interesting little company. I mean, I'm a bit of an automotive nut, as you know, two wheels and to a lesser extent four wheels. But this company was founded in 1982 by a guy called Tony Best, and it's the company provides diagnostic services, and they develop vehicle systems both for road safety, for driverless vehicles, robots. A whole plethora technological offerings that apply to the automotive industry. They've got an illustrious history. They've worked with McLaren, Williams Formula One teams. They've recently secured a contract with a Chinese organization to help develop road safety features over there. And on the 3rd of October, that's a couple of days back, they announced a trading update, and they said that revenue and pre-tax profits for the period will be slightly ahead of forecasts. And this is, of course, in the run-up to the results on November the 15th. There's good support amongst the investment community. Both Panmure Gordon and Cantor rate the stock as hold, and have consistently produced notes for this company. The company raised $5.5 million last year to further develop itself, and it has a great board. Tony Best is still on the board, but also I took a look at the chart prior to this, and the stock is at an interesting inflection point on the chart as well. You've got a 200-day moving average. I should just say, first of all, the epic code is ABDP. It's been as high as 632p on the year, as low as 434p, currently trading at 595p. Now, from a charting standpoint, the stock has consolidated really since May this year, but the 200-day moving average is currently at 584p, and the 50-day is pretty well where we are now at 598p. So in the run-up to the results, any test of the 200-day moving average, I would say, offers a great opportunity to get into this stock. It's a quality company. It's been going for years. And, it's not been a spectacular growth company, but it's had a pretty good year so far this year. And there's every sign that there's more to come.
So ABDP, is it?
ABDP, yes.
Yes, yeah. Oh, that's it. Yeah, I couldn't. I was getting confused with that. A-B-D-B-A-P-T-T-B-B-B. Cool. All right. Marvellous. Yeah, it's on the 200 moving average there. So
it is. Yeah, that's right. So results are announced on November 15th. And I think this is, you know, given the trading statement, the stock has consolidated a bit. So if it dips down a bit further towards that 200 day, I would expect to bounce back off that. But that could be a very good point to buy. So put it on your watch list.
Put it on your watch list. Do some research. Nothing on D-Y-O-R. This in podcast is investment advice. Anything else, Al?
Yeah, a company we've spoken about before, Redstone Connect, REDS. It's the former Comms PLC. Now, this was the stock was picked out by my colleague Dr. David Paul at VectorVest earlier on this week, and is interesting on a number of levels. The company provides managed services and software solutions for property and smart buildings, commercial spaces, and it's in that area. It's got a number of products. It won a very prestigious contract earlier this year to supply the IT and cabling systems to Tottenham Hotspur's new ground. And being a Spurs fan, obviously that got my attention. But the company put out a trading statement ahead of the interim results, which are due out next week. And again, you know, we've spoken before about you know, in the run-up to the results, it's often a good time to buy or you know, given where the stock is trading on the chart as well. But the trading statement said it was the company was pleased with progress during the first half and said it was trading in line. It's got a new offering of a real estate management software platform called OneSpace, and it's commenced the rollout of that. It's also integrated an acquisition it made last year, Andersen Kern, and that's acquisition has provided great skill sets and a positive contribution going through the year. CEO Mark Brond said the performance is expected to be weighted into the second half, and they're very confident for the outcome of the full year. But what was also interesting was the VectorVest chart that David Paul put up on the post showed that the earnings growth rate had been flagged up as one of the metrics on the VectorVest system. When the shares were trading around about £1.20. They're now trading at 134p, but the valuation that's attributed by the combination of the VectorVest metrics is around 174p, so arguably the stock still remains undervalued. There was also...
Sorry, what's the ticker again? I've lost the ticker. What was it again?
REDS, R-E-D-S.
Oh, yeah, R-E-D-S. Yep. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So there was also a mooted takeover by a company called AP Systems, and the company put out a note yesterday to say that wasn't happening. So the stock fell back a tiny bit. But really, any pullback at this point is, in my opinion, a great opportunity to buy this company, given the valuation that VectorVest has attributed to it. It's clear, you know, the company's earning well, the acquisition's integrated well. We're in the run-up to the results next week, so any pullback in the next few days I would view as an opportunity to buy. But
yeah,
again,
cool.
Do your own research.
Yeah, yeah, and talk about football. I'm not a huge fan of football, but I know that Harry Kane's on fire, isn't he?
Oh, isn't he just? Isn't he just? Yeah, it's a wonderful thing. It's great to see these young English players coming through. And you know, obviously, in you know previous years, you had sort of the likes of Teddy Sheringham and David Ginola and co. But Harry Kane is a wonderful striker. Obviously, supported by Dele Alli and Harry Winks and all these other young England lads. So it's great to see.
Do you know what? Just an idea. I was just thinking there about stocks and shares, and I thought, you know, if you could buy some shares in him, you know, a couple of seasons ago or whatever.
Oh yeah.
But
yes.
Surely that's by I suppose because they're pretty much owned by football clubs, aren't they? But a good way of, I suppose it's like the AIM market of football players. You just buy stock in a player before they get signed or anything. You're just going to see them, you know.
Yeah.
We should set this up, Val. So basically you go around the country, you know, as scouts kind of thing, and you list players. And they say, right, you know, and their fathers say their father will back them and they back them. You get other people around the back them saying, you know, it's not hard to find, I suppose. You just go to a local team and say, who's the best player here? And say, okay, it's potential, you know, future superstar. And you buy shares in a player, a future player.
Well, it happened down here. I mean, my boy played for a football team in Brighton and he's at he was great friends with this other lad, and this other lad had a cousin, and they used to go and kick a football round regularly. He joined the Junior Seagulls, and he's now playing for Brighton Hove Albion. A chap called Lewis Dunk, who's the centre back for Brighton, and he's also made the England squad too. So it can happen. It's a great thing. So yeah, as you say, from an investment standpoint, if there were an opportunity or a way you could actually invest into these players, and if a fund were created, or if a scheme were created, possibly through crowdfunding or something, then that would be a great way to do it. But risky, but you know, the potential growth from that, that's why these football agents make so much money, you know, because they take a player on the books when he's sort of coming through the ranks, and you know, they look after him, and then sort of 5-10 years later, you know, maybe he sells on for 80 million quid, and that's it, made for life.
It's nuts, isn't it? Or 200 million.
Or 200 million, yes.
It's like a mid-cap.
That's right, yeah. One player, a mid-cap company. You know, it's astonishing.
Cool. Lovely, Al. Have a nice week, and speak to you next week, fella.
Thanks, Jess. All the best. Speak next week.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five, always there, Ascent Resources, AST. At four, Rehbold Resources, RBW. Been there quite a few times of late. At three, it's Safron Energy. Just talked to Michael Masterman, CEO there, on the podcast. That's SRON. At two, I talked to Graham, CEO of Motive Bio, MTFB. And number one, most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, was Frontera Resources, FRR. Okay, top five most liked RSs are as follows. At five, Ortac Resources, OTC. Ortac Resources Limited, first gold assay results from their Akianga deposit, I think it is. At four, Highlands Natural Resources, H&R. Highlands Natural Resources appeals extended drill timelines at East Denver. At three, SDX Energy, oil discovery at Rabul, two well in Egypt. At two, Premier African Minerals, that's Le Kaza mining update, first assay results. And number one, most liked RNS, was from EVR Holdings. Now, they signed a 2-year agreement with Rock Nation. Rock Nation. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Much appreciated.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
The Financial Times guides you through complex issues. In divisive times, don't settle for black and white. When you need the full perspective, turn to FT.com. Become a subscriber today. Search for FT subscription.